Now we're on to the first of the wise intentions, the intention of renunciation, and, or maybe we should say non-lust, something like that. Renunciation is, of course, not the most popular word in American culture. So sometimes people say letting go. I think that's also pretty good. The positive form, just like the equivalent of metta and karuna, or loving kindness and compassion, would be generosity, I suppose, giving. But I think renunciation is a lot broader than generosity. It includes it, but would include many other things also. I actually kind of like the word renunciation, and I think it's misunderstood because it conjures up for us images of deprivation and, you know, willpower. People kind of imagine forcibly denying themselves things that are actually enjoyable or useful or even necessary for life. You know, I don't know, the mind dramatizes the word renunciation sometimes. Sometimes there's also a sense of willpower going with it, is that if we're renouncing, it must be that we really wanted it, but we're going to, you know, grit our teeth and somehow accomplish that. So I've painted that a little bit dramatically because I want to say forget that image. I don't think it's very helpful. I want to offer a different picture during this section. So when the mind is really functioning within wise view, all three of the wise intentions are actually very natural. And so I want to paint the picture that renunciation or letting go is something that the mind actually would want to do when it's seeing things in terms of suffering and the end of suffering. So consider say the role of desire in your life, but not just any desire, the particular kind of desire that's called out here that we might call craving or compulsion, something like that. It's that thirsty, grasping kind of desire. We have this to some degree as humans. We all have stuff like that that we're attached to. And what it does is that it binds the mind to various pleasures, to various objects or ideas or people, such that we think that that object or person or idea is necessary for us to be happy. I must have my coffee every morning or I can't function. I've had people say that to me. Or I must get that promotion at work. If I don't get that, who will I be? You know, something like that. And if we don't get what we want, in cases where we've attached this graspy kind of desire onto it, then we feel frustrated or we fall into despair or depression of some kind, which is basically suffering. You know, we suffer when we have this associated grasping kind of mind. And then the really cruel part is that even if we do get that promotion at work or whatever it is, then we have to worry about defending it. Then we're afraid of losing it. You know, since we finally got what we wanted, we better keep it, defend it, protect it. More suffering. It's all suffering when that kind of desire or craving has arisen. So this type of desire is really a kind of bondage, actually. And the image I like is that we get led around by the nose, like one of those, you know, the bulls that have the bull ring in their nose. Ouch, right? And you just get led around by that, by our various wants and other things that we think we need to have. One image from the suttas, actually, is that sensual desire is like debt. It's like being in debt. And you continually are having to pay to this craving that's putting us in debt all the time. So renunciation is when we stop playing that game. You know, when we're not going to be led around in that anymore. So we say, you know what? I don't actually need that. I'm going to be happy without it. I'm not interested in playing that game of hope and fear and despair and desire and all of that. We just say, I'm not going to play that game. And then we find it's It's pretty natural to let go of craving once we see very clearly how it leads to suffering. The reason that we don't let go of it so easily is because we haven't seen quite clearly enough. We're doing the cost-benefit analysis, and it seems like the benefit is still kind of worth it. So we're still getting hooked by that underside of it. But when we look and we're willing to see clearly that particular kind of desire, not any kind of desire, we still have desires, but that particular edge that comes to it where it becomes craving or grasping or lust, as it's called here, lust could be lust for power, lust for money, lust for sex, whatever it is, lust for coffee, chocolate. When that is present, always there is suffering together with it. You know, that just has to come together. So that's one mode, is to be willing to really feel the suffering that goes with that kind of desire, and really open to how that feels in the body and the mind. And then it's like, oh, I don't think I want that. The flip side can also be done, which is to contemplate the benefits of letting go, the benefits of not being bound to something, not being so attached in some way. There's this real freedom to not feeling like you need a certain status in the world, not feel like you need certain objects. It's like, I'm fine without that. And you may not want to choose the thing that you're bonded to start that with. Start with something that you don't feel that you need to achieve in the world. You must have something that you don't feel you need to achieve in the world. For example, I would be perfectly content if I lived my entire life and I never scaled Mount Everest, which is good because it's probably not going to happen at my age and with the particular body I have. It's just really not going to work. Now imagine if I really thought my life would not be complete if I had not scaled Mount Everest. I would be suffering, but I'm not, because I'm not attached to that. It's not of particular interest to me. So feel that difference. Start with something that you really don't have an interest in, and feel that it's just free. It's not that you don't want it. I don't want to scale Mount Everest. Why? I don't need that. I can just be free of it. So pick something like that and just feel that there's no sort of wire between you and that, no rope. And then pick something where you do care about it to some degree and feel that. And this is not something that's a wholesome, healthy, natural human desire, but something that you have that graspiness to. This is another area where people sometimes get a little confused about what the Four Noble Truths say. They do not say that desire is the cause of suffering. As Uttejaniya says, even wisdom wants things, which is kind of true. Even wisdom wants things. Wanting to be free is a wonderful want, wanting to help others. We may need to go through some layers of whether or not we have other motivations tied in with those, and gradually shed the ones that are related to ourself, basically. But there are wholesome desires. So we're really looking at the ones where there's some attachment involved. So it's said when we trade in the limited happiness of getting something that we want for the more exalted happiness of letting go of wanting it, we've traded candy for gold. Mm-hmm. I like that analogy, and that the implication is clear. I mean, I don't know how much you care about gold in particular, but candy is something that we can want, but it's really not that good for us, right? And as we think we want it, and then after the fourth piece, we feel kind of sick. So it's the same thing with this grasping kind of desires. We may get those things, but, so you get that promotion at work and then you want another one. And then pretty soon you're the president of the company and you have a heart attack because it's such a stressful position and you didn't really want all of that. You kind of wish you were back being the guy, delivering the stuff in the truck. That was more fun. So, there's this way, that's the candy, and we just go for it, but it kind of makes us sick. Whereas the gold is when we traded that in for the happiness of letting go, of non-clinging. And if we keep doing that and we keep making better and better trades, if you have that kind of mindset, we'll eventually find the happiness of liberation. Letting go of all of those cravings. This is from the Dhammapada. If, by forsaking a limited ease, one would see an abundance of ease, an enlightened person would forsake the limited ease for the sake of the abundant. It's pretty clear, but it's interesting to know. I'll just put in this historical note for you, that when the first translators found this, I mean, the very first time that English-speaking people were translating the Pali Canon, they got to that one, and they put a little footnote next to it that said, this is so obvious that the Buddha would probably not need to say this. But if you look at how people live, I don't know how obvious it is, actually. The translators thought that was pretty clear, but it may be clear intellectually. But do we actually do that? How many times do we catch ourselves going for something that's not that good for us? So I guess after all this, I'll say, do you think renunciation doesn't sound that good? It's freedom. It's letting go of that candy and that grasping and that treadmill and the rat race that you get into. So the only thing that we have to renounce are the causes of suffering. That sounds pretty good, doesn't it? That's not bad. And interestingly, despite this association with willpower, genuine letting go is not an act of will. The more you see it, the more you realize that. I don't know exactly what it is, but there's certainly will involved in doing the practices, keeping attention, having the right motivation, whatever it is that we can, actually I don't know that we can will our motivation either. But letting go is something that kind of happens when all the conditions are in place for it. When we've seen the suffering clearly enough, something in the heart is convinced, this is just no longer worth it. And we can even have a sense of not worth it, or you know, there's a name for that term on the path when we get sort of sickened by something, by seeing the way the mind is going for it. We kind of just say, I'm not going to do that anymore. And then it's kind of more natural. You may have to put effort into getting those conditions in place, but then the letting go is not done by the will. This is from Bhikkhu Bodhi. When we methodically contemplate the dangers of craving and the benefits of renunciation, gradually we steer our mind away from the domination of craving. Attachments are shed like the leaves of a tree, naturally and spontaneously. The changes do not come suddenly, but when there is persistent practice, there is no doubt that they will come. I like that image because the tree doesn't have to throw its leaves off. It's not pushing that, you know, forcing itself to let go of those leaves. But the leaves don't come off just automatically. They come off when the conditions are right. It's gotten cool. The tree has realized that it's fall, and so it's withdrawn some of the nourishment to the joints where the leaves are attached, and then they can fall off. So we do the same thing. We gradually denourish the unwholesome roots of greed, hatred, and delusion. We see very clearly that the situation is not helpful when we're grasping or hating or being deluded. So we have some understanding and we have some sense of where our energy is going, and we do that consistently. Eventually, it's like the tree and the leaves will fall. This is also a helpful image so that we don't get too caught up in believing that we are the ones who are letting go. I mean, it's not true anyway, but it's also not helpful to be thinking along the way, I have to do this, or I'm the one who's going to do whatever to make this let go. So I guess just as one example, I know some of you have done this and some of you are going to do this later this month, is that a residential retreat is a wonderful opportunity at renunciation. This is a short stint of going to a place and, you know, leaving your life behind, leaving your electronics behind, and just doing the practice for however many days the retreat is. And people don't always think of that. You think you're going on retreat as a positive act, and it is an act. You're going there, you're doing it, you had to make arrangements to get there. But a lot of it is about this wonderful letting go. It's so delicious. And think about the things that you let go on retreat. You let go of having to create your own schedule and figure out when you're doing what. They give you a schedule. You may have reactions against that, but you just follow it. You give up making your own food. And again, you may have to bring some special food if you have certain needs, but basically someone else is cooking for you and it's pretty good food. But actually, even if it's not, even if the food is very simple, like it is at some retreat centers, you don't have to deal with shopping, with cooking, with dealing with the leftovers, with putting it away, with cleaning up, unless your yogi job is washing dishes. So, you know, there's that. You don't have to make too many decisions about dress because you bring, unless you bring a huge suitcase on retreat, but mostly people just bring, I mean, kind of simple stuff and you're not sweating a lot during the day. And so, you know, you can wear your same clothes again and again. Many of the mundane details, you don't have to wash your clothes, you don't have to put gas in the car, you don't have to take care of appointments or buy things to fix the house. You know, all that's just gone. And then also, many of your social roles are gone because you're not talking. And so, you know, who are you? Who knows? Sometimes people think, you know, this sounds horrible, but I don't know too many people who go through all of that and don't come out at the other side shining, beaming, relaxed, wishing they could stay another day. There are retreats where you're really glad that it ends. But for the most part, people are amazed at how light and open and relaxed they feel, and open-hearted also, because we don't have all of our usual aversions operating. Mostly we're getting good food, getting to live simply and easily and not dealing with other people too much. And so the hatred kind of gets denourished, and what's left, love and compassion. So you may not think of that as renunciation, but that's what renunciation feels like. That's how good it feels. That's why this is one of the wise intentions, is to live more and more from a place that's obviously in our real life, we have those things to do. But then we start to wonder, well, how can I bring some of those feelings I had on retreat into my life? Are they really only tied to the retreat conditions? And the answer is no, it's a setup. We're setting you up at the retreat to feel these things so that you'll want them in the rest of life. And they are possible. It's just a mind state. You can help to create conditions in your life that are more supportive of being easeful, being relaxed, living from a place of non-clinging. To practice renunciation is to pass from gross entangling pleasures to an exalted happiness and peace, from a condition of servitude to one of self-mastery. Desire ultimately breeds fear and sorrow, but renunciation gives fearlessness and joy. This is how I like to see renunciation. So this is the third of the wise intentions, is the intention to live without clinging quite as much, even if it's just a little less. And any ease or joy or openness that comes from that is the joy of renunciation. It's beautiful. Okay. So then once again, we'll have a chance to talk a little bit about this factor, and we'll have time also afterwards for discussion and questions. So I think I'd like to I've been talking enough, I'll get you guys talking. So let's try to find groups of three, and I know there will be some that aren't three, and try to find at least some different people than you had before. Okay, so the first question is, describe a time when you let go of some kind of sense pleasure, foregoing a treat, cutting back on internet time or some other habit, etc. As we learned in the first part, don't focus too much on the story, just give the outline of it. And I'd like you to, if you can, evoke what it felt like to let go and what opened up when you let go of that sense pleasure, It can be a very simple example. Don't try to think of your heaviest, deepest. So describe a time when you let go of some kind of sense pleasure. Focus on what it felt like to let go of that or to not have that, to renounce that, and what opened up when you did. Okay, and then the second question is reflecting on what we've talked about today with the various kinds of wise intention, the ones that address hatred or ill will or cruelty, and the ones that address desire or lust or craving. What feels, quote unquote, juiciest to you right now about practicing with wise intention or exploring intention? What seems like it's sort of floating to the surface for you right now? Anything today that felt rich and interesting? And we'll just let each person speak again. So the first person can go. All right, so it's a chance to share anything in the larger group or also to ask any questions. But I'm curious about something, anything that might have come up on that one. Sounded like you were having some pretty lively conversations. Yeah.
I appreciate hearing other people's, like, what it's bringing up in them. And, you know, that it just really puts the concepts in a really alive place. And I had a question about your prompter. You said, think of something that you want, but not like a wholesome human desire. I think you kind of gave that caveat earlier, and I was just, like, how do you draw that line?
Uh-huh.
I mean, I think even, like, the word lust, I think of, like, sexual desire. But I think that's a wholesome human desire. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah, I think that line changes over time. And it's dependent on people's circumstances also. You know, they're in... Even letting go itself is not always the what's called for in a certain situation. Can be very, if somebody has just lost somebody very dear to them to death, it's not very compassionate to say, well, everything's impermanent. You know, it's true, but it's not very beneficial. So, you know, that might not be the time for them to be focusing on how can I let go of this person who's just died. It might be more about, you know, a wholesome grieving process and having good memories and, you know, putting a picture on their altar and things like that. So I think it's very circumstantial where the something that's a healthy desire or something that's more of the craving lust kind of desire. And as always, the distinguishing feature is whether or not we're suffering, whether there's that grasping feeling. And we get more and more sensitive to that. So that's why the line changes also, is that over the course of our practice, things that might have been in the realm of, well, this is okay earlier, we start thinking, actually, I can feel the suffering of this now. And so that needs to change. It's a refinement process. Does that help? Yeah, we're always looking. This is why wise view has to do not only with what we think is wholesome or unwholesome, but also actually checking, is there suffering or is there not? Is there contraction in my system or not? And that, you know, that too is circumstantial. So we learn to get more attuned to that. But it's okay to want things. Just be aware that you're wanting them. Sometimes we go for things and we didn't feel the want before that, and we're missing an opportunity there since wanting is a really big part of suffering, right? So just keep watching what you want. Yeah. Andreas, did that help? Okay, Andreas.
Oh, I was just thinking that this is something by Daniel Siegel, who said you can enjoy something, but it's different if you need it.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So you make that distinction with a lot of sense.
Of enjoying versus needing. There's that compulsion feeling when you say need. Yeah.
Yeah. moment or something, or can I know I enjoy it, and can I don't know to say oh, it's not good for me in the moment. So no. So I like that.
Yeah, healthy enjoyment. There are sometimes things we think we're enjoying, but we're not actually enjoying them if we look more carefully. Yeah, it's a very, very interesting area, is to look at desire and clinging and all of that. Really a long-term practice there. Yes?
So, you know, we're talking about sensual desires and lusts. How about, you know, like, a clinging to a certain resentment of another person, for example.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we do that a lot.
Right? And so are we the same? Is this quote-unquote applicable to that? Or is it, you know, because when I think of clinging, it's a very broad, you know, attachment's very broad. It could be attachment to material things. It could be attachment to people, it could be attachment to circumstances, opinions.
Yeah, no, specific attachments are actually what's being pointed at. So, in fact, even the attachment in a given moment is what's being pointed to. Because there are moments where, you know, I don't know if I'm ever really attached to this water bottle, but there are moments where it's totally fine, and then there are other moments where if somebody tried to take it away from me, I'd defend it in some way. So I don't know if that's a good example or not. But you gave the interesting example of holding on to a resentment to someone. This is a really interesting area because resentment, we know, is something that doesn't feel good to us. So why in the world would we cling to that? But we do, right? It's really a strange thing about the mind, is that it actually holds on to things that are suffering in some ways. And so seeing that movement, for me, that evokes a lot of compassion. You know, is that the mind is so confused, it's even holding on to something that is painful to me. Because resentment, of course, resentment may affect the other person negatively by my making snide comments to them or avoiding them. But before any of that happens, I suffer from the resentment. I suffer from the closeness of my heart, and
So kind of resent, in that case, I mean, I see it playing in both the lust and, you know, the hatred zone.
They go together because they're two sides of the same coin. So often when we're wanting something, we're also not wanting something else. Not always, but almost, I'll say almost always. And they're not always just parallel. You know, sometimes we really want this promotion. Mm-hmm. It's because we don't want our partner to think that we're not ambitious enough or something. It's some complicated thing like that. So we have what we want and what we don't want, or what we're avoiding. And you can play with looking at both sides of that. You can see which side tends to be more visible to you. We're learning also about how easily we can see things in our own mind. There are some things that are very easy to see and some that are hard for us to see. That's a good point. Yes, Eileen.
I really liked your metaphor about steering the ocean liner, because it just gives me this visceral sense of how deeply seated some of these patterns and habits are.
Yeah, it can take a while. And the flip side of that image, the positive side, is once you've got the ocean liner going in a really good direction, it's going, and it can really just unfold with its momentum. Mm-hmm.
I just experienced a lot of resistance.
Well, how did that feel, first of all?
the harmless addiction. So-called harmless addiction. It doesn't hurt anyone else. It doesn't hurt me. But it's an addiction. And as soon as I started thinking, well, I'll tackle that. Boy, this resistance came up. I want that.
What did the resistance feel like? How did you know you were resisting?
I felt like crying.
Okay. Yeah. So it came.
Don't take that away from me.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Like the little child whose lip is quivering as you. Yeah.
I can also see all the suffering. This trauma. Yeah. The bondage. It doesn't feel like suffering so much as the bondage, not being free.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And that's ultimately where the freedom matters, is in our own heart, in our own life. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it was just telling.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing that. So we can hold that with a lot of compassion. Yeah, Kevin.
I've resonated a lot with the story of the, giving up a bag of candy for a bar of gold. And, you give up a little bit of good to gain a lot of good. And it's really helped me in my practice with renunciation. Mm-hmm. Instead of looking at renunciation of giving something up, I look at it as, what am I gaining from it? So, I can, let's say like an addiction to like social media, like I can give up, my Facebook account. And, that can be kind of hard because it's like, well, I like those adrenaline hits when I get a like, and like, that feels really good. But, giving that up, what am I gaining? I'm gaining a lot of time in my day. And that
to be with real people. Need of, like, yeah.
When I do post something that doesn't get a like, that sucks. And, you're giving up one aspect of something that feels good a little bit, but you're gaining like so much more.
Yeah, it can be helpful to tune into that when it's the case. Yeah, thank you.
I'm just curious, how do the things like, where you're craving, prestige or success, admiration, that kind of thing. It's not on a first level, it's not a sensory thing, but it is absolutely,
it's absolutely a craving. Yeah.
And so yeah. I'm just wondering how that fits into this whole framework.
Yeah. It's said that there are, we have three kinds of craving, I guess it said. Craving for sense pleasures, craving for becoming, which is all what you're talking about. So it's craving for identity of some kind or status or power, whatever it is. And then also craving for not becoming, which is interesting, that we crave for things not to be true about us or something like that. So it fits into the bigger picture of craving. In that way, is that the Buddha did distinguish between things that are coming into just our five senses and things that are more about our identity and our place in the world. He knew humans are very relational beings and that we have a lot of craving around relationship also.
Although I guess now that you're saying that, I mean, he actually said the mind, it's a sixth sense, right?
He does.
Like, so
yeah.
If you count that, then.
So if you look at it in terms of the sense bases, then you would say it's something that's a hit in the mind. Yeah. So you could put it in the sixth sense. Yes, that's correct. One more quote to read from Greg Scharf. He points out that renunciation, which is sometimes called letting go, is also basically the practice of not clinging. So that's the practice of the third and fourth noble truths. So that's why it's an extension of right view. So he frames that nicely in this quote. Renunciation is seen as so important in this tradition because it is held as the very practice of freedom. Rather than being presented as something dismal or bleak, renunciation is seen and described as a practice of joy and happiness, and its ultimate fruition is the greatest happiness, that of peace. So this is, it's the real thing to be practicing letting go. Again and again, the suttas say that somebody was liberated through non-clinging. That's another one of those non-words, like non-ill will or non-cruelty, non-clinging. You can do anything except cling. It's nice. There's a lot of things that are not clinging. So, and anything that is clinging has suffering associated with it. So we see the link between these wise intentions and the wise view of the Four Noble Truths that we talked about last time. Okay. Well, maybe we've gotten a good introduction to this one, and you guys are ready for a month of practice. It's going to be good. I mean, how bad can it be to do non-clinging, metta, and karuna? I mean, this is going to be a good month. So then there will be the resistance to those. So thank you, everyone. And the wise speech session will be on December 9th. Oh, and Betsy has an announcement.
I'd like to remind everybody.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.